Well, good morning. I want to welcome you this Sunday and a happy Sunday after Easter to everybody. If you're not familiar with our church or if you're just tuning in for the first time to our live stream, allow me to introduce myself. I'm Pastor Matt. I've been with this church for about 10 years now this summer. And for the last few months, though, SUMC has started to kind of plant a new vision and a new hope for a faith community over on the west side of Cleveland in and around the Ohio City neighborhood. And I have the wonderful privilege of being able to kind of lead that and start that up. So as that's going on, I ask for your continued prayers in that. I have to admit, the last few weeks have been difficult for that as far as it's going, but we have great hope and we've made some great relationships already. So keep us in your prayers as that endeavor goes on. And this morning now, I get to share the message with you the Sunday after Easter as we'll be exploring the Beatitudes. But before we get started into our message, I just want to take a quick moment to acknowledge that I know that this hasn't been an easy time for anybody. For some, these last few weeks have been a real struggle, and it's been an emotional and a mental adjustment to a new normal, and separation from families and friends have probably taken their toll. And for others, the past weeks have been downright devastating and very painful due to work or a diagnosis of a loved one. And so wherever you fall on that spectrum, we just want to remember that we are the body of Christ, the church. And in being so, we enter into those spaces of pain and struggle with one another the best that we can. So as this continues on for the foreseeable future, I just hope we're all able to exchange comfort and encouragement and healing any way you safely see fit. And in somewhat of an unplanned response to all of this, our church is going to spend this post-Easter season for the next few Sundays discussing a series of passages which I think are perfect for right now. We're going to examine the Beatitudes from the Gospel of Matthew in chapter 5. And while Easter wraps up the end of Jesus' ministry, the Beatitudes go back to the very beginning. In this section of verses we'll be looking at over the coming weeks, Jesus is on a small hill along the Sea of Galilee. In fact, the image we're using for our website and slides and online bulletins is a photo of the Sea of Galilee taken by a couple who go to our church, Brian and Chris Sheets, and they took that picture just a couple months ago when they made a trip to the Holy Land. Now, much of Jesus' ministry in the coming years will take place right along this sea where he's about to do this talk. And this talk he's about to launch into, as you may have heard in the welcome, is called the Sermon on the Mount. But before he addresses the crowds with the Sermon on the Mount, he turns and quietly speaks to a handful of disciples, explaining to them these Beatitudes. And in doing so, it's like he's telling them, I'm going to teach a lot over the next few years. I'm going to do a lot of ministry and healing and work. And in order to understand the type of work I'm going to do, you need to understand these Beatitudes first. So he says to them, blessed are the poor in spirit, those who mourn, the meek. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Blessed are the merciful and the pure in heart. Blessed are the peacemakers and those who are persecuted for doing the right thing. In all, he gives these eight blessings upon the people listed. He's like an author writing an introduction to a book almost. Authors write introductions to their books so they can give a reader a context or a heads up for what they're going to encounter in the book or the story ahead. So Jesus lays out these Beatitudes almost to say, you're going to need to know a few things in order to make sense of the work that I'm about to do. But the kinds of things he lays out in the Beatitudes don't make much sense. Because each of these Beatitudes are radical blessings that are given to very alternative types of people. They are people who don't just know how to mourn or how to be pure in heart. They are mourners and they are pure in heart. These alternative people have made these characteristics a part of who they are. And the people listed aren't the kinds of people who tend to have power and means. They didn't have power and means in the ancient world of the Mediterranean during Jesus' time, and they don't have power and means now. We don't list peacemaker or poor in spirit on our resumes as hireable qualities. But before Jesus starts any teaching, He brings up these Beatitudes. Before we are to understand the depth and meaning and beauty of the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, we have to understand his introduction. So that's what we'll be doing over the course of the next few weeks. Today, we'll explore the first type of person listed and the blessing which they receive in Matthew 5:3. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. It's a simple 13-word blessing that gives power and hope to people. To begin, this is a blessing. It's not a pity party. It's not saying, well, you seem down and like life's against you, but cheer up because God loves you. It's not that at all. A person poor in spirit sees past that weak platitude anyway. You can't fool a person who is poor in spirit with some shallow encouragement. You've probably seen someone poor in spirit, or maybe you are that person. Something has happened in their lives which has brought them to the end of themselves. There's nothing left in the tank. They can't find the energy inside to care about what anybody thinks anymore. They can't put on the show any longer. They can't judge anyone else because they don't have the power or energy to bring themselves any higher to be able to look down on anybody either. They've realized that no matter how hard they try to succeed in this life, they can't manufacture the thing that their spirit or their heart really desires. The person who is poor in spirit is the person who has abandoned the attempt for control over their lives. But they've abandoned control in a good way. It's a good way because if Jesus is right about all this, this is exactly the starting point of an abundant and blessed and full life. Now, everyone will experience or is experiencing something that is meant to shock them out of themselves, oftentimes over and over again. The shock could be small or quite large. Think of things like unmet expectations, failure, fractured relationships, job loss, tragedy, and about a million other things. And each time we experience these shocks, we're reminded that we aren't in control, and we either surrender or we fight back for control again. The surrender is hard, but it's very important. But you can see it in people when they've been to that point in life. Those people don't care to manage their image on Facebook moms groups anymore. They tend to be less concerned about what their neighbors think. And I'm not talking about the people who loudly say, I don't care what anybody thinks anymore, I'm going to do me. You care. You care. The ones who have really surrendered and become poor in spirit stop caring about their image, not to spite everyone else, but they've surrendered because they know that their health and the health of the loved ones depends on them finding peace. And they know that they can no longer find it by managing their image. They can only find it by surrender and a full reworking of how they pursue what they desire most. And the ones who have been to that point can tell that others and who the others are that have been to that point as well. The poor in spirit have a common language that only the poor in spirit tend to understand. This is the same with a lot of different fields of expertise as well. For example, you can think about firefighters or people at the gym or teachers. They all have a common language. If you were to walk into the presence of any one of those groups, there is an understanding that they all have that you must learn as a new person to that area. Same goes for the poor in spirit. They've been to a point in life where they now acknowledge has emptied them and all of their ego. They understand something about their unique position that is different for a lot of other people who haven't been there yet. Over and over again, we are reminded that the veil which separates our happiness and comfort from the chaos and mayhem of life is extremely thin. And the longer we push that reality off, the further we separate ourselves from the kingdom of heaven. The poor in spirit are always well aware of the thinness of that veil, and it's never lost on them. The truth of knowing that they don't ultimately control the transition from comfort to chaos frees them to live in the grace of God and on a path toward the kingdom of heaven. The blessing for the poor in spirit is that theirs is the kingdom of heaven. The kingdom of heaven has always been hard to understand. It's contradictory in that way. Because we mentally think it's one thing, but our souls are wired to detect it in a completely different way. We mentally label it as some reservation in the clouds for good people. And we try to be good enough to get to this place. Do you remember having to write an essay or complete a test in school? The class is all quiet, and then you turn your test into the teacher's desk, and on your way out, you think to yourself, well, I hope that was good enough. I tried my best. Hopefully, I'll get that passing grade. We treat life a lot like that, like we're trying to mark down the right answers to get some passing grade. Some people have become frustrated by this, and they said, forget the test. I'm not putting down any answers. Others have said, well, the person next to me seems to know what they're doing on the test, so I'm just going to copy off them. And then other people still just try to work hard to get all the right answers put down. But there's a sense that this is wrong, because it is. Because we aren't glorified test takers, and God is not a teacher behind a desk with a red pen waiting to grade your life. And while we are mentally drawn to act that way, our souls feel something else. Our soul desires freedom and life and peace and justice and harmony and connection and love. Our souls desire the very qualities and characteristics of the kingdom of heaven. We are creations of God, so we bear our Creator in us. And that element of God in us is like a compass that points us back toward God and ultimately the kingdom of heaven. There's a reason it's for the poor in spirit, though. The proud in spirit can't detect the kingdom. Their internal compass, which points to the kingdom, is too crowded out by other priorities. That's the profound call of Jesus here. If you're broken or lost or confused or defeated, if you're poor in spirit, then you're on the way, because the secrets of life are detectable then. The acquisition of things only fogs our ability to sense the way, the truth, and the life toward the kingdom. Being poor in spirit is to be low. It's to have our egos reduced low enough to detect the image of God in ourselves again. And when we detect the image of God in us, we start to find the kingdom of heaven again. The paradox of the poor in spirit having the kingdom of heaven is quite wonderful, because it states that those who have nothing actually have access to everything, and those who stake their lives on anything except the kingdom actually have nothing. The kingdom of heaven is everything our souls desire and everything we're wired to want, and access to the kingdom of heaven comes through realizing that we have nothing. Perhaps the most difficult and to understand part about being poor in spirit, or any of the rest of the listed Beatitudes, is that no one can out of nowhere just decide to be any of them. You can't just decide to be poor in spirit, because all of the listed Beatitudes are actually responses that we make to our circumstances. And while we can't just decide to be poor in spirit, everyone at this very moment has circumstances which demand our response to lead us there. Being poor in spirit is going to cost us, ultimately. It involves us being honest about ourselves and our circumstances. It means a removal of our ego and pride, and it demands that we relinquish the false pretense of control that we claim over our lives. Because in the kingdom of heaven, there is no room for any control except God's, no room for any pride or ego, and certainly no room in the kingdom of heaven for any type of approach except a fully honest one. So first, in order to respond in a way that allows us to become poor in spirit, we have to be honest about ourselves and our circumstances. Oftentimes, the first step in change is an awakening to ourselves. It's a painful dose of self-awareness. In the Gospels, Jesus was always working the most with widows, the sick, the poor, the marginalized, the outcasts. And it's not because they needed the most help, because everyone needs help, but it's because that they were the most aware of their needs. So when Jesus comes out and proclaims, "I have come to give sight, free prisoners, and give good news to the poor," The ones who were honest about themselves and their needs turned and listened. They weren't too proud to admit who they were. Now, on the other end, the political leaders and teachers of the law at that time had plenty of need as well, but they weren't aware. And every time Jesus would do something miraculous or divine or beautiful, they would be upset and try to find something wrong about that, an indication of a heart detached from its inner compass, the image of God in themselves. Instead, it was a bleeding woman who admits that it was she who touched Jesus's cloak. An ethnic woman begs for healing for her daughter, even though she's not Jewish. And a tax collector admits that he cheated people out of money for his whole career. Again and again, the people whose lives are changed and awoken are the people who are aware of their vulnerabilities. It's the people who know how their actions affect others. It's those who feel hurt and sense that hurt that exists in their lives most honestly. And often what separates us from sensing our vulnerabilities is our own egos. So next, acknowledge your ego and let it die off. The reason we can't be honest about ourselves is because our false self or our ego is feeding us lies about who we should be. This is what it means to be tough. This is what all good parents do. This is what a patriot is. This is what a real man is. And so on and so on. It's everywhere. It's all the time. And the false messages never turn off. And as time progresses, these lies and these messages only get louder. The false self or ego is pretty easy to detect in someone, though. Ask yourself, what types of actions, people, or statements cause a visceral emotional response out of me? For example, it's a running joke between me and my friends that they can get me to do something insensible and absurd just by saying, "I knew you wouldn't do it." That triggers a need in me to prove myself. It's a pull at my ego that causes me to do something otherwise ridiculous. From there, I can ask, why do I sense a need to prove myself? And from there, I can find out lies about my self-image that I believe and where I need validation in order to be accepted. I have many other false egos at play, but those are none of your business right now. Our egos, though, insulate us from our self-awareness. They block out truth. Ego kept the teachers of the law from being able to hear Jesus's teaching and healing. Ego takes otherwise good parents and forces them to compare themselves with other parents on Instagram. Ego tells otherwise really good husbands that they deserve attention from someone other than their significant other. Ego tells otherwise healthy people that they won't be happy unless they reach some unrealistic image standard. So it's no wonder that the kingdom of heaven is for the poor in spirit. Their lack of ego and admission of need allow them to be receptive enough to sense it. And finally, in order to be able to respond to our circumstances and move to become more poor in spirit, we have to realize that we don't really have the kind of control that we think we do. It's like watching kids build with blocks. They build these delicate towers, and when they get really high, they say, "Don't touch it or you're going to knock it over." And they work so hard to keep everyone else away from these block towers, which oftentimes people don't stay away. And the tower always comes down and there's always a meltdown and fight. But even if they do keep everyone else away from the tower, it's always at the expense of yelling and fighting and arguing. But ultimately, that block tower is dependent on the earth not shaking, the house not settling, or the floor not moving. Control over that block tower is just an illusion. It's fun to watch kids build these towers, but it becomes a problem once the child tries to protect and control that tower at all costs. And so I feel like God watches us sometimes with the same dread as a parent watches a child building a tower of blocks. Because we build these delicate lives of education and job applications and relationships and savings accounts and success and recreation and raising kids and planning and a stable home. And it's cool. It's cool. But then we get like a child and we start to control all the circumstances around it. Don't touch my tower. And I feel like God looks at us as we fight for control and thinks, you know, that tower won't stand because you're controlling it. It'll stand as long as the ground doesn't move underneath it. And the ground is always moving. Economic downturn, job loss, tragedy, pandemic, you name it. The world reminds us that we are not in control. The sooner we give up control, the sooner we can begin to live life again. Giving up control doesn't mean we abandon hard work. It just means that we don't define ourselves by the kind of tower we built. Giving up control means that God builds a tower through us. To be clear, it's thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven, not my will be done. So my hope this week and in the coming weeks of the Beatitudes is that we'll be able to redefine how we understand the words of Jesus Christ, and in doing so, we redefine how we live in this world. And while these past few weeks and the coming months won't be easy for most of us, we have to remember that it hasn't been easy for a lot of people for a very long time. The poor in spirit have always been around, and the poor in spirit have always been pointing in the direction of the kingdom. So I offer you this. Blessed are the lonely in isolation as they seek connection right now. Blessed are the families who visit through windows. Blessed are those who lost jobs and are uncertain about the future. Blessed are those who continue to work and commute in ways which increase their exposure. Blessed are the healthcare workers as their courage makes them our healers. Blessed are the sick in hospitals struggling to recover. Blessed are those who endured suffering long before this outbreak. Blessed are you as you face the challenges of this pandemic. And blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Amen.